Well, it's a long psalm, and I won't be able to address every line, but I trust and pray we'll be able to access where it's heading, what its main thrust is. I wonder if you've ever taken a photograph and looked at it and thought, that captures the moment perfectly. Or you've seen a portrait of someone and thought, that is them, that's them. I've never seen such a clear image of what they are. It sums them up. Or you've seen a newspaper photograph and thought, how brilliant that that has just captured that event, its grief and its crisis or its pain in just that one photo. Well, what would you write if you wanted to sum up being human? In just a few words. To capture the essence of true humanity in a fallen world. What would you write? And I ask it because I think that is what this psalm does. It captures humanness in a fallen world in one concentrated 36 verses. And I'm going to try and draw five answers to the question, what does it mean to be truly human in a fallen world, from the first three quarters of the psalm? And you may want to say, hold on a second, that's not the whole story. And I will get to that objection towards the end. So my heading's this. What does it mean to be truly human? Well, firstly, from verses 1 to 5, if you're truly human, you will be hurt very deeply. We don't know what prompted the psalm, but just look at the start of it. He begins with a very short prayer, save me, O God. And then the bottles uncorked, the floods just open gates. It all pours out. Save me, O God, for the waters have come up to my neck. I sink in the miry depths where there is no foothold. I've come into the deep waters, the floods engulf me. I am drowning. Now, I've never seen anyone drown. And I can only begin to imagine the terror of it. They do it on Hollywood films fairly well. Just after the time I left the army, a fellow soldier of mine on exercise, on the very next exercise that the battalion I went on, died in a flash flood in Kenya. And I had some reports of how it went, but I can just imagine him trying in vain to cling to anything that would float before losing his grip and being washed away down in this river, desperately grasping for breath, blind panic. And that's the psalmist here. I'm out of my depth, I'm losing my foothold, I'm holding on to life by the skin of my teeth. I don't think I can stay afloat much longer. The floods engulf me. And verse 3 tells us it's not a short-lived crisis. I am weary, worn out from calling for help. My throat is parched. His throat's so sore because he's been crying for so long. He's longing for God to intervene, but there hasn't been any intervention. He's looking, but nothing has come. And what's wrong? Verse 4. Those who hate me without reason outnumber the hairs of my head. Many are my enemies without cause. And then he's accused of a crime he's not committed. I'm forced to restore what I did not steal. Injustice. And to be hated is horrid, isn't it? We've experienced it, perhaps. I don't know about you, but when a relationship with just one person seems to go wrong, it is painful. And you lose sleep at night, and you feel awful. But to be hated without cause by many people, I don't think there are many sufferings that go much deeper than that. And this psalmist is right there. Every fibre of our being and his cries out for vindication. It's not fair. I didn't do it. That's not what I meant. But it doesn't touch the pain. There's a well-known Scottish minister called Donald MacLeod, an author. 10 years or so ago, he was falsely accused of sexual misconduct and offences with no shred of basis in fact. But the accusation meant that it had to go to court. And between the time that he was accused and he went to court, there was rumour mongering by the press. And there was lots of people thinking there's surely no smoke without fire. When it came to trial, he was vindicated completely. It was found to be a conspiracy by other free churchmen. No charges were kept, it was all dropped, but still it was so damaging and so hurtful. I don't know what to make of verse 5. It may be a confession of sin to God. You know my folly, O God. My guilt is not hidden from you. It looks like a straight confession, but The whole thrust of the psalm seems to be from the perspective of an innocent sufferer. So either here we've got an example of an oversensitive conscience. Maybe you've experienced this. A godly sensitive person who's accused of something you've not done. You don't leap to your own defense confidently, but rather you dwell on your own failures. Lord, you know what a failure I am. And just at this moment, I feel more of a failure than ever. Or perhaps we've got an indignant and desperate man saying, Lord, you know if I've done anything wrong. I can't hide any guilt from you. And the implication is that he's appealing to God, who alone at least knows the truth. Anyway, these first few verses are about real hurt. If you're going to be truly human, you will face real hurt, and the others follow. You'll be treated as they treat God. Why was he hated without reason? Verse 7. I will endure scorn for your sake. Shame covers my face. He's treated like this because he stands closely aligned to God, in God's shoes perhaps. May those who hope in you not be disgraced because of me. I'm so close to you, they're scorning me. I'm sad for what it'll do for you. And yet standing up for God doesn't do him any good, does it? Verse 8, I'm a stranger to my brothers, his closest family, alienated. They're treating him the way they treat God, that's why. I'm a stranger to my brothers, an alien to my mother's sons. Now, many a convert from Islam knows that kind of thing. Cut off, banished, alienated from their family. And I guess some here will know what it feels like to be strangers to your family for your faith. We love them, but over time we find ourselves with less and less in common with them. And it's not surprising, is it? Because if God means nothing to them, if the astonishing, wonderful love of Christ that we know means nothing to them, then we're not going to have so much in common. It shouldn't be a surprise that true humanness will experience division in families over Christ. Verse 9, the insults of those who insult you fall on me. He's so close to God here that insults that are targeted at God hit him. He's standing side by side with him and it hurts. There is mocking, verse 12. Gossiping, bawdy songs being written. I'm the song of drunkards, it says. Can you imagine a man trying to shield his children from that kind of singing outside his house? Daddy, what are they doing? And there's swearing and four-letter words and innuendo and mockery and hatred and ugly voices all just outside the door. That is the psalmist's lot. That'll be ours too. People are treating him the way they treat God. Perhaps it's no exaggeration. He is broken. To be truly human, you will hurt deeply and you will be treated as God is treated. Thirdly, you're only going to endure that being human if you know God. By verse 13, there is still the mire and the flood and the pit and the distress and the enemies. The circumstances haven't changed, but there's a change of tone. And I guess you heard it as Pete was reading it to us. But I pray to you, O Lord. And then do you see how he reels off the characteristics of God? What a great example of prayer to describe God. In your great love, answer me. With your sure salvation, answer me with the goodness of your love. In your great mercy, turn to me. This man knows his God. He is the strong, committed, loving God, and he prays to him. So what does it mean to be truly human? It means you'll be deeply hurt. They'll treat you as they treat God, and you'll only be able to endure if you know God. For you'll be very lonely, verses 19 to 21. Scorn has broken my heart and left me helpless, it says. It's not true to say that this man is only looking to God for help. He's looking to his friends. He's looking to his fellow human beings. And he's finding no human comfort there either. No sympathy. He's longed for someone to do the equivalent of get alongside him, to cook a meal, maybe spend some time, just listen, sit with him through the pain. And instead, what do? The opposite. They gave him poison for a meal and were showing him gratuitous cruelty. He's deserted. He's misunderstood. This is what it means, I think, to be truly human. And lastly, verse 22 to 28, you're going to long for some justice, for a fair world. Now, I reckon we'll struggle with these verses. I don't know if you felt that while we were reading them. Verses 22 to 28. May the table set before them become a snare. May it become retribution and a trap. He's saying, please give my enemies what they deserve. May their eyes be darkened so they can't see. May there be no one to dwell in their tents. Let them be blotted out of the book of life. And we wonder what to make of that kind of prayer. Haven't we been told to bless our enemies and pray for those who persecute us? This doesn't sound like that. So what's going on? Well, there's lots that could be said, but here are just two things to say. Firstly, it's a prayer. This is not the man seeking vengeance himself. He's not proposing to take the law into his own hands. It's not a personal vendetta. It's a prayer to God for justice, however hard we find it. And the second thing to think about is, what is motivating him? It's not vengeance, but it's a God-given longing for justice, for fairness, for righteousness. There is a conviction here that the Creator God is here, and there is a just judge of all the world, and he must do right. So he can't be content with the way the things are. This universe is a moral universe, and if wickedness goes unpunished, then it tears at the heart of the whole fabric. There's a famous commentator called Emil Brunner who's written this. If God did not punish sin, there would be no seriousness in the world at all. No meaning in anything. No order, no stability. Chaos and desolation would be supreme. All order in the world depends on the certainty that those who rebel against God will be punished. That's the motivation this guy's praying from here. That's the motivation of verses 22 to 28. It's not a Christian prayer for us living this side of Christ. But we're not to reject the motivation, the longing for justice. Let's hold on to that. So what does it mean to be truly human? It'll mean, this psalmist writes, being deeply hurt, treated as people treat God, being very lonely and longing for justice. And it'll go on a long time. Your throat will be parched for crying. So here's the question. Now, is that your experience of life? Are you desperate, worn down, hated, insulted? Do drunkards make songs about you? Are you friendless, in pain, comfortless, in sorrow? And I guess there'll be a lot of answers, different answers in this room to that question. And they'll vary in degrees, but actually they'll be, I presume, yes and no. Some of that I recognise, but not all of it. I hear bells of recognition when I recognise some of the pain. But if I take the package as a whole and say that that sums up what my human experience is, then surely I'm going to say, no, that's not the whole story. We've all got something we can point to. There's an optimist in all of us. We have times of companionship, happiness, prosperity, things to savour, to enjoy, to delight in, and to look forward to. Now, it'd be really sad, wouldn't it? If somebody came home from honeymoon or came back from hospital with a brand new baby and when asked, how are you feeling at the moment? And they said, well, Psalm 69 sums me up. That'd be awful. They said, no, there's got to be something better than that. That would be a pity. Well, if this psalm encapsulates what it is to be a human being as God intended us to be in this fallen world, and if the picture painted in the psalm we know is not the whole story, we know more of an experience than that, why not? Well, the New Testament answer is that there's only ever been one fully human being living here who has lived as God intended him to live. And Psalm 69 is fulfilled only by him. He's the one who's plumbed its depths. And listen as I go through some of the echoes in the New Testament of this psalm, how it's quoted regularly in the New Testament. John 15, verse 24 to 25, on the night before Jesus died, speaking to his disciples, Jesus said, they have hated both me and my Father. But this is to fulfill what was written in their law. And then he quotes verse 4 of our psalm, they hated me without reason. The psalm's about him, the truly human man. And we did hate him, didn't we? The cradle to the cross, Jesus had enemies without number. Herod tried to kill him within the first few years of his life. Early on in his ministry, the Pharisees and others also began plotting to kill him. Judas took all the benefits of his friendship and then betrayed him. And the list goes on. In John chapter 7, his own brothers did not believe in him. when he burned with righteous indignation, went into the temple, overturned the tables there. We read in John 2 that his disciples remembered verse 9 of our psalm. Zeal for your house would consume me. Here's the man who was consumed with a burning desire for the honor of God. Paul quotes the second half of verse 9 in Romans 15. Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the insults of those who insult you have fallen on me. Here's a man so close to God that he gets the insults that are targeted at God all the time. Verse 20 to 21 of our psalm, loneliness. I looked for friends and found none. We say, well, what about Peter and James and John? Weren't they close friends? Didn't you have some disciples? Yes, he did have them. But what happened in Gethsemane? He said, come and pray with me. Come and be with me in my deepest hour of need. And they fell asleep. And then at the cross, he was terribly alone. The moment of his deepest need, he was deeply deserted, mocked and jeered. And uniquely, of all human loneliness, that loneliness was 100% undeserved. When he said from the cross, I thirst, what did they offer him? Verse 21 of our psalm, they gave me vinegar to drink. Even those difficult verses, verse 21, 22 to 28, they're quoted twice. In Acts 1, Peter quotes, may this camp be desolate, let no one live in it. He was saying that is the destiny of the ungodly. In Romans 11, Paul quotes verse 22 and 23 of this psalm, of those who rejected Jesus at the first. And although the New Testament doesn't make an explicit connection, surely these last verses of the psalm fulfill the final joyful verses and fulfill the hope of resurrection. Vindication, thanks, praise. Jesus Christ in his life and death and resurrection filled full the meaning of the psalm. So if we want to find an image that encapsulates true humanness in a fallen world, we find it on a Roman cross. All the dilution of suffering that makes the world bearable for us, the friendships, the happiness, the joyful things that we have, were totally taken away from Christ at the cross. They evaporated for him there. And there we're faced with a horrifying concentrate of suffering and death. That's who this psalm is about. It's about Jesus. So what do we do with it? How do we take what's here, if this is about true humanness and it's about Jesus, and apply it to ourselves? Well, here's three short applications. We should be very grateful. How can we remain zealous as Christians all our lives? How can we avoid falling into cynicism and indifference, wallowing in the mire with no hope of getting out of it? Well, read the Gospels and fill your hearts and minds with the person of Christ, the person who's been there. And we should read this psalm, because together with Psalm 22, which we heard about last week, it gives us an insight into what it was like for Jesus to suffer and die. And doesn't it bring home forcefully that Jesus did this, and how he felt and how he suffered? And whoever you are this morning, he's holding out the gift. He did it and he felt it and he suffered it for you, for us. We've got to be very grateful when we see this. And shouldn't we be encouraged by Jesus' sympathy? Hebrews in the New Testament tells us that we can, because in every respect he's been tested as we are and yet without sin. Do you recognize any of what Jesus went through as we read that psalm? Well, take heart, because he's been there and he'll stand with you in the darkness. Be encouraged by Jesus' sympathy. And lastly, shouldn't we have realistic expectations of what this life is going to be like? What we expect is very important. Either we're going to say, I never expected it would be like this, and we'll end up depressed and in despair. Or we'll say, yes, this is awful, but I was warned it would be, and so we persevere. We're not going to end up with shallow optimism or blank despair, at least not for long. We'll be out of those places fast. There's a story about a man who committed suicide. He was a top mathematician. A week after he got a first at Oxford in maths, he jumped off the Clifton suspension bridge, killing himself. And an interview with his supervisor, not a believer himself, said, well, he didn't think there was any point to life. And then added, well, of course, there is nothing to live for, is there? Now, if that's right, then that young man did the logical thing. But he's not right. Someone has said that it's not suffering that destroys us, but suffering without meaning and purpose. And this psalm blows a hole through shallow optimism and blank despair, and it faces human suffering head on and says, there is one who drank the cup of human suffering right to the bottom for you. Jesus was crucified and rose victorious. Points to glory at the end there. This is the pattern of the psalm. And Jesus, do you remember on the Emmaus Road what he said? Was it not necessary that the Messiah must suffer these things and then enter his glory? And that's the thrust I think this psalm does. Suffering first, glory later. And to a degree that's necessary for his disciples, for anyone who follow in his footsteps. The good times in this life are anticipations of heaven, and they are to be treasured and enjoyed. And the bad times, dare I say it, are normal. That's what the psalm's saying. They oughtn't to surprise us. The pattern for the disciple will be the pattern of the master, won't it? Suffering now, glory later. Now, it's pretty hard to believe. With that as my expectation for now and glory as my expectation for later. But that is the experience and the challenge of Christian discipleship. So treasure the psalm. Treasure Christ. Hold on to these descriptions of true humanity, especially when you're in the depths of suffering. Well, it's a long psalm, and I won't be able to address every line, but I trust and pray we'll be able to access where it's heading, what its main thrust is. I wonder if you've ever taken a photograph and looked at it and thought, that captures the moment perfectly. Or you've seen a portrait of someone and thought, that is them, that's them. I've never seen such a clear image of what they are. It sums them up. Or you've seen a newspaper photograph and thought, how brilliant that that has just captured that event, its grief and its crisis or its pain in just that one photo. Well, what would you write if you wanted to sum up being human? In just a few words. To capture the essence of true humanity in a fallen world. What would you write? And I ask it because I think that is what this psalm does. It captures humanness in a fallen world in one concentrated 36 verses. And I'm going to try and draw five answers to the question, what does it mean to be truly human in a fallen world, from the first three quarters of the psalm? And you may want to say, hold on a second, that's not the whole story. And I will get to that objection towards the end. So my heading's this. What does it mean to be truly human? Well, firstly, from verses 1 to 5, if you're truly human, you will be hurt very deeply. We don't know what prompted the psalm, but just look at the start of it. He begins with a very short prayer, save me, O God. And then the bottles uncorked, the floods just open gates. It all pours out. Save me, O God, for the waters have come up to my neck. I sink in the miry depths where there is no foothold. I've come into the deep waters, the floods engulf me. I am drowning. Now, I've never seen anyone drown. And I can only begin to imagine the terror of it. They do it on Hollywood films fairly well. Just after the time I left the army, a fellow soldier of mine on exercise, on the very next exercise that the battalion I went on, died in a flash flood in Kenya. And I had some reports of how it went, but I can just imagine him trying in vain to cling to anything that would float before losing his grip and being washed away down in this river, desperately grasping for breath, blind panic. And that's the psalmist here. I'm out of my depth, I'm losing my foothold, I'm holding on to life by the skin of my teeth. I don't think I can stay afloat much longer. The floods engulf me. And verse 3 tells us it's not a short-lived crisis. I am weary, worn out from calling for help. My throat is parched. His throat's so sore because he's been crying for so long. He's longing for God to intervene, but there hasn't been any intervention. He's looking, but nothing has come. And what's wrong? Verse 4. Those who hate me without reason outnumber the hairs of my head. Many are my enemies without cause. And then he's accused of a crime he's not committed. I'm forced to restore what I did not steal. Injustice. And to be hated is horrid, isn't it? We've experienced it, perhaps. I don't know about you, but when a relationship with just one person seems to go wrong, it is painful. And you lose sleep at night. And you feel awful. But to be hated without cause by many people, I don't think there are many sufferings that go much deeper than that. And this psalmist is right there. Every fibre of our being and his cries out for vindication. It's not fair. I didn't do it. That's not what I meant. But it doesn't touch the pain. There's a well-known Scottish minister called Donald MacLeod, an author. 10 years or so ago, he was falsely accused of sexual misconduct and offences with no shred of basis in fact. But the accusation meant that it had to go to court. And between the time that he was accused and he went to court, there was rumour mongering by the press. And there was lots of people thinking there's surely no smoke without fire. When it came to trial, he was vindicated completely. It was found to be a conspiracy by other free churchmen. No charges were kept, it was all dropped, but still it was so damaging and so hurtful. I don't know what to make of verse 5. It may be a confession of sin to God. You know my folly, O God. My guilt is not hidden from you. It looks like a straight confession, but the whole thrust of the psalm seems to be from the perspective of an innocence sufferer. So either here we've got an example of an oversensitive conscience. Maybe you've experienced this. A godly, sensitive person who's accused of something you've not done. You don't leap to your own defense confidently, but rather you dwell on your own failures. Lord, you know what a failure I am. And just at this moment, I feel more of a failure than ever. Or perhaps we've got an indignant and desperate man saying, Lord, you know if I've done anything wrong. I can't hide any guilt from you. And the implication is that he's appealing to God, who alone at least knows the truth. Anyway, these first few verses are about real hurt. If you're going to be truly human, you will face real hurt, and the others follow. You'll be treated as they treat God. Why was he hated without reason? Verse 7. I will endure scorn for your sake. Shame covers my face. He's treated like this because he stands closely aligned to God, in God's shoes perhaps. May those who hope in you not be disgraced because of me. I'm so close to you, they're scorning me. I'm sad for what it'll do for you. And yet standing up for God doesn't do him any good, does it? Verse 8, I'm a stranger to my brothers, his closest family, alienated. They're treating him the way they treat God, that's why. I'm a stranger to my brothers, an alien to my mother's sons. Now, many a convert from Islam knows that kind of thing. Cut off, banished, alienated from their family. And I guess some here will know what it feels like to be strangers to your family for your faith. We love them, but over time we find ourselves with less and less in common with them. And it's not surprising, is it? Because if God means nothing to them, if the astonishing, wonderful love of Christ that we know means nothing to them, then we're not going to have so much in common. It shouldn't be a surprise that true humanness will experience division in families over Christ. Verse 9, the insults of those who insult you fall on me. He's so close to God here that insults that are targeted at God hit him. He's standing side by side with him and it hurts. There is mocking, verse 12. Gossiping, bawdy songs being written. I'm the song of drunkards, it says. Can you imagine a man trying to shield his children from that kind of singing outside his house? Daddy, what are they doing? And there's swearing and four-letter words and innuendo and mockery and hatred and ugly voices all just outside the door. That is the psalmist's lot. That'll be ours too. People are treating him the way they treat God. Perhaps it's no exaggeration. He is broken. To be truly human, you will hurt deeply and you will be treated as God is treated. Thirdly, you're only going to endure that being human if you know God. By verse 13, there is still the mire and the flood and the pit and the distress and the enemies. The circumstances haven't changed, but there's a change of tone. And I guess you heard it as Pete was reading it to us. But I pray to you, O Lord. And then do you see how he reels off the characteristics of God? What a great example of prayer to describe God. In your great love, answer me. With your sure salvation, answer me with the goodness of your love. In your great mercy, turn to me. This man knows his God. He is the strong, committed, loving God, and he prays to him. So what does it mean to be truly human? It means you'll be deeply hurt. They'll treat you as they treat God, and you'll only be able to endure if you know God. For you'll be very lonely, verses 19 to 21. Scorn has broken my heart and left me helpless, it says. It's not true to say that this man is only looking to God for help. He's looking to his friends. He's looking to his fellow human beings. And he's finding no human comfort there either. No sympathy. He's longed for someone to do the equivalent of get alongside him, to cook a meal, maybe spend some time, just listen. Sit with him through the pain. And instead, what do? The opposite. They gave him poison for a meal, and we're showing him gratuitous cruelty. He's deserted. He's misunderstood. This is what it means, I think, to be truly human. And lastly, verse 22 to 28, you're going to long for some justice, for a fair world. Now, I reckon we'll struggle with these verses. I don't know if you felt that while we were reading them. Verses 22 to 28. May the table set before them become a snare. May it become retribution and a trap. He's saying, please give my enemies what they deserve. May their eyes be darkened so they can't see. May there be no one to dwell in their tents. Let them be blotted out of the book of life. And we wonder what to make of that kind of prayer. Haven't we been told to bless our enemies and pray for those who persecute us? This doesn't sound like that. So what's going on? Well, there's lots that could be said, but here are just two things to say. Firstly, it's a prayer. This is not the man seeking vengeance himself. He's not proposing to take the law into his own hands. It's not a personal vendetta. It's a prayer to God for justice, however hard we find it. And the second thing to think about is, what is motivating him? It's not vengeance, but it's a God-given longing for justice, for fairness, for righteousness. There is a conviction here that the Creator God is here. And there is a just judge of all the world. And he must do right. So he can't be content with the way the things are. This universe is a moral universe. And if wickedness goes unpunished, then it tears at the heart of the whole fabric. There's a famous commentator called Emil Brunner who's written this. If God did not punish sin, there would be no seriousness in the world at all. No meaning in anything. No order, no stability. Chaos and desolation would be supreme. All order in the world depends on the certainty that those who rebel against God will be punished. That's the motivation this guy's praying from here. That's the motivation of verses 22 to 20, verse 28. It's not a Christian prayer for us living this side of Christ. But we're not to reject the motivation, the longing for justice. Let's hold on to that. So what does it mean to be truly human? It'll mean, this psalm is right, being deeply hurt, treated as people treat God, being very lonely and longing for justice. And it'll go on a long time. Your throat will be parched for crying. So here's the question. Now, is that your experience of life? Are you desperate, worn down, hated, insulted? Do drunkards make songs about you? Are you friendless, in pain, comfortless, in sorrow? And I guess there'll be a lot of answers, different answers in this room to that question. And they'll vary in degrees, but actually they'll be, I presume, yes and no. Some of that I recognise, but not all of it. I hear bells of recognition when I recognise some of the pain. But if I take the package as a whole and say that that sums up what my human experience is, then surely I'm going to say, no, that's not the whole story. We've all got something we can point to. There's an optimist in all of us. We have times of companionship, happiness, prosperity, things to savor, to enjoy, to delight in, and to look forward to. Now, it'd be really sad, wouldn't it, if somebody came home from honeymoon or came back from hospital with a brand new baby, and when asked, how are you feeling at the moment? And they said, well, Psalm 69 sums me up. That'd be awful. They said, oh, no, there's got to be something better than that. That would be a pity. Well, if this psalm encapsulates what it is to be a human being as God intended us to be in this fallen world, and if the picture painted in the psalm we know is not the whole story, we know more of an experience than that, why not? Well, the New Testament answer is that there's only ever been one fully human being living here who has lived as God intended him to live. And Psalm 69 is fulfilled only by him. He's the one who's plumbed its depths. And listen as I go through some of the echoes in the New Testament of this psalm, how it's quoted regularly in the New Testament. John 15, verse 24 to 25, on the night before Jesus died, speaking to his disciples, Jesus said, they have hated both me and my Father. But this is to fulfill what was written in their law. And then he quotes verse 4 of our psalm, they hated me without reason. The psalm's about him, the truly human man. And we did hate him, didn't we? The cradle to the cross, Jesus had enemies without number. Herod tried to kill him within the first few years of his life. Early on in his ministry, the Pharisees and others also began plotting to kill him. Judas took all the benefits of his friendship and then betrayed him. And the list goes on. In John chapter 7, his own brothers did not believe in him. When he burned with righteous indignation, went into the temple, overturned the tables there, we read in John 2 that his disciples remembered verse 9 of our psalm. Zeal for your house would consume me. Here's the man who was consumed with a burning desire for the honor of God. Paul quotes the second half of verse 9 in Romans 15. Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the insults of those who insult you have fallen on me. Here's a man so close to God that he gets the insults that are targeted at God all the time. Verse 20 to 21 of our psalm, loneliness. I looked for friends and found none. We say, well, what about Peter and James and John? Weren't they close friends? Didn't you have some disciples? Yes, he did have them. But what happened in Gethsemane? He said, come and pray with me. Come and be with me in my deepest hour of need. And they fell asleep. And then at the cross, he was terribly alone. The moment of his deepest need, he was deeply deserted, mocked and jeered. And uniquely, of all human loneliness, that loneliness was 100% undeserved. When he said from the cross, I thirst, what did they offer him? Verse 21 of our psalm, they gave me vinegar to drink. Even those difficult verses, verse 21, 22 to 28, they're quoted twice. In Acts 1, Peter quotes, may this camp be desolate, let no one live in it. He was saying that is the destiny of the ungodly. In Romans 11, Paul quotes verse 22 and 23 of this psalm, of those who rejected Jesus at the first. And although the New Testament doesn't make an explicit connection, surely these last verses of the psalm fulfill the final joyful verses and fulfill the hope of resurrection. Vindication, thanks, praise. Jesus Christ in his life and death and resurrection filled full the meaning of the psalm. So if we want to find an image that encapsulates true humanness in a fallen world, we find it on a Roman cross. All the dilution of suffering that makes the world bearable for us, the friendships, the happiness, the joyful things that we have, were totally taken away from Christ at the cross. They evaporated for him there. And there we're faced with a horrifying concentrate of suffering and death. That's who the psalm is about. It's about Jesus. So what do we do with it? How do we take what's here, if this is about true humanness and it's about Jesus, and apply it to ourselves? Well, here's three short applications. We should be very grateful. How can we remain zealous as Christians all our lives? How can we avoid falling into cynicism and indifference, wallowing in the mire with no hope of getting out of it? Well, read the Gospels and fill your hearts and minds with the person of Christ, the person who's been there. And we should read this psalm, because together with Psalm 22, which we heard about last week, it gives us an insight into what it was like for Jesus to suffer and die. And doesn't it bring home forcefully that Jesus did this and how he felt and how he suffered. And whoever you are this morning, he's holding out the gift. He did it and he felt it and he suffered it for you, for us. We've got to be very grateful when we see this. And shouldn't we be encouraged by Jesus' sympathy? Hebrews in the New Testament tells us that we can, because in every respect he's been tested as we are and yet without sin. Do you recognize any of what Jesus went through as we read that psalm? Well, take heart, because he's been there and he'll stand with you in the darkness. Be encouraged by Jesus' sympathy. And lastly, shouldn't we have realistic expectations of what this life is going to be like? What we expect is very important. Either we're going to say, I never expected it would be like this, and we'll end up depressed and in despair. Or we'll say, yes, this is awful, but I was warned it would be, and so we persevere. We're not going to end up with shallow optimism or blank despair, at least not for long. We'll be out of those places fast. There's a story about a man who committed suicide. He was a top mathematician. A week after he got a first at Oxford in maths, he jumped off the Clifton suspension bridge, killing himself. And an interview with his supervisor, not a believer himself, said, well, he didn't think there was any point to life. And then added, well, of course, there is nothing to live for, is there? Now, if that's right, then that young man did the logical thing. But he's not right. Someone has said that it's not suffering that destroys us, but suffering without meaning and purpose. And this psalm blows a hole through shallow optimism and blank despair, and it faces human suffering head on and says, there is one who drank the cup of human suffering right to the bottom for you. Jesus was crucified and rose victorious. Points to glory at the end there. This is the pattern of the psalm. And Jesus, do you remember on the Emmaus Road what he said? Was it not necessary that the Messiah must suffer these things and then enter his glory? And that's the thrust I think this psalm does. Suffering first, glory later. And to a degree that's necessary for his disciples, for anyone who follow in his footsteps. The good times in this life are anticipations of heaven, and they are to be treasured and enjoyed. And the bad times, dare I say it, are normal. That's what the psalm's saying. They oughtn't to surprise us. The pattern for the disciple will be the pattern of the master, won't it? Suffering now, glory later. Now, it's pretty hard to believe. With that as my expectation for now and glory as my expectation for later. But that is the experience and the challenge of Christian discipleship. So treasure the psalm. Treasure Christ. Hold on to these descriptions of true humanity, especially when you're in the depths of suffering.